The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It is Friday the 6th of March 2026, 5 minutes past nine, and we have a glorious day across the northwest. It is a chilly start, but it's nice and bright, and I hope it's the same wherever you are. A packed show coming up a little later on in the programme. We'll answer your legal questions with Seamus Gunn, our resident solicitor. So if you have any questions for him, get in touch with us now. I'll remind you of the numbers, 086 60 25000, your WhatsApp and text, or give us a call on 07491 25000. As I mentioned to Lee there, we've a special podcast, the Greg Hughes podcast, released every Friday at 11 a.m. And my guest is Mr. Michael Sugrue, who hangs up his scrubs next week, next Thursday, in fact, and has exciting plans of his own. We'll have a chat to him. And as I say, he's an interesting character, and you'll learn an awful lot more about him. And this hour is dedicated to
the Friday panel on The Greg Hughes Show.
Right, Leonard Watson, owner of Watson's Menswear, Letterkenny. Good morning to you, Leonard.
Morning, Greg.
Good to have you on the programme. And we're joined also by Nicholas Crossan, former independent councillor in the Inishowen Municipal District. Good morning to you.
Good morning, everyone.
And lastly, and not leastly, Councillor Brian Carr, Sinn Féin councillor in the Glenties Municipal District. Good morning to you, Brian.
Morning, Greg, and all the listeners.
And I'm delighted to have all three of you on, don't get me wrong, but it is not lost on me that today is International Women's Day, and every single week we have a woman represented, or two women, or three women represented on the panel. And we have two women produce this programme, but because of schedules and the forward planning of this, it just as it turns out. So, lads, you know, I had to reference that early on because we represent women very strongly on this show, as do Caroline and Shannon. But it just is what it is. Right. Okay. How is all getting on? Is it all good? Yeah.
Yeah.
All good. Yep.
Okay. I might start with this one, if you don't mind. We've been contacted by a number of social people living in social housing, effectively residents of the council, you could say. They've been subjected, or are being subjected, to a rent review. And some of them are saying, well, what's going on here? Because they are living in houses with defective concrete blocks. In some cases, the windows aren't opening. You know, there's black mould throughout the property. It's costing them an absolute fortune to heat the home, and that's only going to get worse. I'll ask you first, if that's okay, Nicholas Crossan, should those families have the benefit of a rent freeze until their houses are fully remediated, or should they have their rent reviewed like all other social housing residents?
No, Greg, 100%. I agree 100% that they should have a rent freeze. Kind of the remit lies within Donegal County Council. Within that, there's a hardship clause that councillor can make a representation to the chief executive regarding people living in. But we all know the hardship that people's gone through. The reason that I'd like them to get a freeze is because as the people's on, the windows won't close, there's extra heating on, there's mould, it's not a healthy environment that they're living in, and it's a terrible situation that we've found ourselves in. And I do agree that there certainly should be a rent freeze, and I'd like to extend it, because there's people who are living in private houses that are on the same boat, but they're caught with the banks, unfortunately, you know. So I think that with Donegal County Council, we should make special representation to the minister and ask that there has to be something done regarding this.
Yeah, and I suppose we're talking about what's within the council's gift, and if you have defective concrete blocks and that's been certified, you do get a break from the local property tax, which is something, I suppose you could say, from the council for private home owners. This may well come before you, Councillor Brian Carr, by way of a motion. Is it something that you will support?
100%, Greg, yeah. People that's living in social housing, you know, the situation at the moment is, like, in my own area here in Glenties, there was houses got a letter to say that they couldn't buy their houses anymore but it was only a visual inspection. A lot of houses have been tested and it's proven that they have defective block. But in my area, it's just a visual inspection. But they as well should fit into a rent freeze. you know, it, just because they're not tested, it doesn't mean that they haven't defective blocks. And as the council have a grade A, B, C, and D, A means that your house seems to be fine, B is slight cracks, C is very visual cracks, and D, and all those people that fit into C and D, any of them should get a rent freeze. It makes no sense that you're living in a house that could have mould or water running down the walls or anything. And the review is not on the house. The review is on the income that's coming into the house.
It is, but that's what feels, I think, for many people, insult to injury, because they're, you can't imagine in the private sector, though it probably happens, that a tenant would be asked to pay more rent every single year based on what they're earning as the property that they're living in gets worse. That it would be very peculiar in the private sector, wouldn't it?
It would, yeah. But the council has the wherewithal to stop this. It's been mentioned so many times. I'm on the DCB committee. It's been mentioned at that. It's been mentioned at the plenary. But it's coming to a stage now that, as you said, a motion will have to be brought forward for this. Because it's just, you know, they're living in these houses and it's all about the uncertainty, Greg. They don't know. And the council, as Nicholas said, the council there are uncertain as well. They're not going to go around fixing doors that's, there's a draft or windows that's rattling. And I'm getting that all the time from the constituents, that these problems are in the houses. But the council are not going to do that. And so it is about all about uncertainty. But as you said, a motion, it's put something into my head now that a motion should be definitely brought forward.
Can the council absorb whatever loss of revenue there might be?
Well, they're just going to have to do something. At the moment, their revenue, they're fixing these houses to try and keep people in them. You know, so that's another expense.
In my view, it's actually the state that should be matching any shortfall, because this is the result of a poor oversight by the state. So I don't think even the council should be on the hook for this. I think that the state should be bridging any issue here.
Yeah, but the problem with the social housing, there's no remediation scheme yet.
No, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's why I believe this
word we're getting from the government is imminent. The scheme is imminent.
And I've been told that by two, maybe three housing ministers already.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They have to step up to the plate, the government. And same with the council at the moment. They're doing maintenance works on some of these houses that's just to keep people in them. As I said, in my own area here, they filled the cracks with special filler. They painted all the houses, which is good to keep the people in the houses longer, to stop the water egressing into the house. But that all cost money. The council have spent 1.2 million already, and that hasn't been reimbursed. So the council can't sustain spending money on that there. And then there's other social housing as well, so that it's coming out of their pot.
And I'm sure there are people living in social housing that is not affected by DCB that are themselves saying, well, why should I pay rent? Because I've been waiting for the council to switch out my boiler for 4 years or whatever it might be. Leonard Watson, what's your view?
Greg, what you said there, you wouldn't get away with this in the private rental like you do, and the state through the council is the landlord. You have to keep the house to a certain standard. These families now, and with the price of heating oil, the extra cost on these families just trying to stay in these houses is through the roof. Like, so as you say, the state should be stepping up. The state should be paying for the repairs, and the state should be paying, covering the rent loss. It's madness. Like I'm saying, no private landlord would get away with this. Like, and they are the landlords. Like.
Yeah, that is the bottom line too, isn't it? But it's a constant battle, Nicholas, isn't it? It's a constant battle just for justice. And, you know, I was very pleased for the families down on the East Coast, whereby it seems with very little public campaign at all, their scheme down there was enhanced. And yet here, we're battling for every little bit of fairness. And it's the people most directly affected that are the campaigners. It's crazy, Nicholas.
Yeah, I agree what you're saying, Greg. What you're saying is here is that we have to fight tooth and nail, and have been for years regarding the defective blocks. But one thing we have to keep in mind, no matter who pays for it, It's the taxpayer that pays for it. It's not the government. The government having two pennies to rub together. So wherever we get the money, should it come out of Donegal County Council budget, should it come from the department, it still goes back on the taxpayer. Unfortunately, and that's what we have, the system that we have in this country.
Lots come on to the taxpayer because at least 21 state employees, including council officials, will travel to the French Riviera to court.
Lovely.
To court institutional investors next week. The Irish Daily Mail revealed yesterday that property developers are paying for the government's pavilion at the event in Cannes, which is expected to cost in the region of €300,000. There are representatives from the housing agency going to that, the Department of Housing, but they're refusing to say how much the trip would cost or where the minister and his officials are staying. It's a bit strange, isn't it? You know, when we're battling away here for crumbs off the table that we have, and it's out there and in the public, developers paying to house the housing department officials, Department of Housing officials out in the French Riviera. It doesn't seem right, that, does it, Leonard? It seems like...
Well, just before Leonard comes on there, just like to say, it seems more like the Galway tent now has moved.
Yeah,
you took the words out of my mouth.
The Riviera rental. Okay. But is that something that needs a bit of scrutiny, do you think, Brian?
Yeah, definitely.
It doesn't seem right. If we're talking about the optics of... At the Bord Beer situation, I mean, this is worse kind of optics, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But we've nearly become accustomed to it now at this stage. As Nicholas said there about the Galway tent, you know, there's many's a time and many's an example has come up over the last number of years about money that's been wasted and squandered by this government. So, you know, they have to stand up and become accountable to the likes of going to the Riviera, being paid by somebody that will benefit from a scheme that the government will give out later on. That's, you know, it's buttering them up, basically, and it has to be been called out by the opposition, but it has to be. At some stage, we have to get some kind of a proper answer.
And Leonard, I'm not suggesting for a moment that any favours will be sought or given off the back of something like this, but it's how it looks, Leonard. It doesn't look right when you've got people who could benefit from government and housing department decisions paying to host those very people on the French Riviera.
Yeah, do you know what, Greg? You have to, you know, when you're in the position, you have to hold yourself above scrutiny. Like, you can never let yourself be caught in a situation where it looks like you're doing favours out there. Do you know what? If this here thing had to go, the government should have, so important to the government to send these people, they should have paid for themselves. You should not be taking not a backhander, but you should not be taking this money or this event from developers, as you say, that you're in hock to them then. Like, you know, you mightn't say you are, but you are in hock to them. Like, you know, they've paid for this here. There's somewhere down the line they will come to you looking for help or, you know, something. So,
well, there's a whole go of officials going, and there's only two of them that are actually listed to speak. So what the other ones are going for, I simply don't know. Right,
you just don't want to go back down this road.
Right. Nicola says, hi, my rent is €1,100 a month. I get HAP, but I also have to pay €83 a week to Donegal County Council. I can't seem to get an answer as to why I have to pay this. To me, it seems like I have to pay this just for being on the council housing list, even though I don't have a council house. Brian or Leonard, as former current councillors, do you understand what that's about? What's the pay? What would a payment of €83 to the council be?
I can't answer that, Greg.
Oh, okay. Give us more details as to what that's about. A caller says, the council are greedy and should never put rents up for a house they can't even uphold to a reasonable standard. Put the rents up in the council houses that are fine and those that have been moved into new houses. I don't think that's fair to say. I don't think the council are being greedy. I think the council are giving a budget. I think they've got a housing stock and they've got a maintenance programme, and they have to, those figures all have to add up in fairness. And that's why I mentioned a little earlier on that any gaps I think should be bridged by the state. And although the council didn't say they were putting up the rent, fill in the form and they won't, but don't fill it in and they won't, or they will up your rent by €20. Okay, I can't say that if you don't fill in the form, they won't. Right, now...
If you don't fill in the form, Greg, they automatically put a €20 increase.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. Yeah, yeah, I get where you're coming from. And I think maybe some people are even peed off that they were asked to do so in the first place.
That's what I was getting, yeah.
Yeah, very soon after Israel and the United States started bombing Iran, we saw dramatic increases in the price of petrol, diesel and home heating oil. The industry, though, has defended its actions. Taoiseach Micheál Martin has said, though, that because most of our oil comes from the North Sea, it is, if prices go up that quickly, gouging. Leonard, do you believe price gouging has been going on? You know, I've been contacted privately by those in the industry that say, look, Micheál Martin's out of step here. He needs to speak to us. You know, this is the way it works. We have to cover the cost of future fuel purchases, and it's not quite as the Taoiseach is laying it out. Or do you believe that people are just making hay while the sun shines, Leonard?
You know what, I was listening to Katie Hannan. I was sent an interview there from Katie Hannan and one of the heads of the oil industry in Ireland. And he says 100% we're not price gouging. But then in his next sentence, he turned around and he says, the reason that we keep putting the price up so high, we're trying to dampen down demand. Like, and she says, but that's price gouging. Like, you know, and he had nowhere to go. Like Greg, I was just listening to the minister yesterday. Oil was at $81 a barrel last February and our prices were nowhere near this. After the start of Ukraine war, it was $122 a barrel. We still weren't at these prices. Like, so I don't know. I would like, they have to come out now and say what is going on, because the difference between the price of a barrel of oil and what they're charging now at the pumps, it just doesn't add up at all.
Well, like, what, say for instance now, and you know, I do use your shop, I must say, right? So at the moment, do you have a suit deal on at the moment? Like, so for a suit, how much would it, so how much is that at the moment, say for instance?
$2.99.
Right. So what the oil companies are doing is that, say your supplier says that, well, I'm sorry, Leonard, in 6 months, you're going to have to charge those $6.99 for that suit, right? What the oil companies or what the companies are doing are saying, right, you would put the price of that suit up now for $6.99 to cover how much that stock's going to cost you in the future. That's what the oil companies are doing. You couldn't, you couldn't do that in your retail business, but that's exactly what they're doing. They try and cover the future purchase price of a product by upping the price now.
But Greg, at the end of the day, I have everything locked in. I have my margin, everything locked into that price. And until the prices goes up, I don't put my prices up. Like, you know, and funny, I was chatting to a guy in the furniture industry yesterday, like, and over the last couple of years, prices have started to come down in clothing that, and we have passed that on. And he was saying even furniture have passed on. Now, we're all worried about the price of containers now. But Greg, it's the sheer jump. I paid $4.95 for oil last week, and I just checked there. It's $6.99 this morning. Mm. Like, that's huge. Like, and oil's gone up about, what is it, $10 or $15 a barrel. Like, you know, that's an absolute, and what you said there is completely right. We have 90 days oil in this country. Like, so they're actually pricing in what the price of oil is going to be now in a month's time or 2 months' time. Like,
is there any argument in favour of what I suppose the suppliers and then the retailers are doing, Councillor Carr?
No. Well, the situation, there is price gouging, as Leonard said. There's definitely price gouging going on throughout the whole country, and it's been linked to the conflict. But like, the conflict started on Saturday night, and on Tuesday there was 30% and 40% increases. It just doesn't make sense. And Leonard was listening to one of the same podcasts as I was listening to. But like, if we're depending on, we've only 2 days supply in this country, you know, it doesn't make sense that that's all we have. That's what he said.
About petrol and diesel, is it?
Yeah. But even all the oil coming in, he said it was coming from Wales, and by the time it was leaving Wales...
Well, my understanding, pardon my ignorance, my understanding is the majority of our... we import crude oil from Norway, and it's refined in County Cork and made into kerosene and distributed around the country. So that oil... that crude oil has been in this country for quite some time already. So we're not buying a finished product.
That's what I'm saying. Like, if they're saying that it's only coming in every 2 days, and by the time the war started, the stuff that we've got into the country since, we have to up the price, which is wrong. Now, I have to say there's certain forecourts and everything that hasn't upped the price. They have stayed, and they're using whatever fuel is used. You used the comparison with Leonard and his suits there. They're keeping the price until that oil is all sold, or that on the forecourt's all sold, and then they will, as the new stuff comes in, they have to pass it on to the buyer then, but they're waiting until that. And you have to, and I know as a motorist, I will be using those forecourts more often because we're all going to know about them because on
Yes,
social media this
but
last couple of days,
there
it's like,
is,
oh.
you know, whatever about gouging, I don't know what you want to call it, but if you took a price in Buncrana or Carndonagh or wherever it might be, I don't want to point fingers at anyone, and some places only have one station. This is not my intention. And then Donegal Town, and then Lifford, and then Dunloe, you could see 15, 20 cent difference.
You can
so
do, yeah.
I presume it doesn't cost 15 cent a litre to get petrol from Lifford to Dunloe. Do you know what I mean? So what there is a huge variance in price. The problem is it's too far to travel to justify it, because by the time you got back, you've burnt the saving.
That's true, yeah. But like we in Donegal, we're losing already because every bit of fuel that comes to Donegal has to come by road. And if the price is dearer in Donegal, the way, but as you said, different towns, different areas, one station in one town. And there's one station in Glenties. I don't even know the price of what's on it at the moment, but I will be finding out. But I'd be travelling to different parts of the county, and if I know that there's a cheaper place on the way, I will start using those petrol stations.
But Nicholas, I do want to sort of represent where, you know, the retailer's coming from as well, because my understanding is they make 6 cent a litre, which is not a fortune either, Nicholas. And they are, you know, they are price takers as well as price setters, I suppose. I think more transparency, more understanding would help in this situation, Nicholas.
Well, I'd like to start off, Greg, I agree with what you're saying on that. And if I could give a few facts on it, there's about 130 euro in tax on your litre of petrol or diesel. We'll take it, we'll leave the home heating oil out of it at the present moment. 80% of, we're dependent on 80% for fuel in this country on oil and gas for our electricity, for our cars, for our homes, etc. So let's take it from, instead of going from a top-down gouging, there's only one person gouging here. That's the government. Because the more it goes up, the more tax they can lift on it. And I have no doubt that it's very great for the ministers to sit back, or the Taoiseach to sit back and say, the petrol companies are gouging. They're, as I said, they're lifting two-thirds of the price of petrol's going on tax. We have enough onshore or offshore wind in Ireland to fuel Europe. We are going to have to go look for it, because are we going to be sitting every week, or there's a war on Iran this week or Pakistan next week, and the price of oil's gone up, the price of our pensions have gone down, the price of this. We're too dependent on something that can happen at a flick of a switch, as we said last weekend. So we must become independent. We have the facilities to become independent. Scotland has made a giant leap on it and putting turbines out floating on the sea. They mightn't look pretty. Personally, I don't see anything wrong with them. 1% of Donegal is designated for turbines. 1% of the land in Donegal. In the national plan, the 2040 National Development Plan for Ireland, the government says they're going to create 60,000 jobs in the between now and 2040. How many is designated for Donegal? The answer is none, because Donegal has not designated anywhere that we can put on turbines out on the water. And people are going to be phoning and they say, oh, we don't want them out. Well, if you don't want turbines out in the water, you're going to have to pay for your oil. And that's simple, because if we can have a war every day of the week in this world that we're living on, unfortunately, and it's going to affect us. So we have to bite the bullet. Ireland can be self-sufficient in wind energy. We're driving everybody.
I think this is a bit of a fantasy there with respect, Nicholas, that we, because we'd be generating this power, that in some way it would be cheaper to us. At the moment, you know, firstly, much of the wind power we generate is lost. We don't even use it. And we've also, to ensure that wind generation development companies would invest, we've linked the price of electric power to the price of gas. Yeah. So, you know, this notion, we've been promised for generations that if we do this, things will be cheaper. We were told that if the electricity market was opened up, power would be cheaper. It's never been more expensive. You know, these companies aren't going to come in and build these offshore wind turbines unless they're guaranteed. A price per unit, and that's going to we're going to pay through our teeth for that.
Why don't we do it? Why do we have to hire everything in? Like in Denmark at the moment, the government is starting to say, let's get experts in and tell us how to do it.
Because we don't do that. The reason why those people are heading off to the Riviera is because the government needs private external investment to build houses in this country, because we can't do that ourselves. So, you know, we can't start from scratch. We have to operate in the world that we're in at the moment, Nicholas.
But we're at the present minute in time, we're told that we're getting billions and billions of corporation tax. And I'm a firm believer that's not going to last forever, because nothing stays the same forever. Let's use that wisely now rather than and spending it nilly-willy around the country. Let's do something that we could export electricity if we did it right in this country. But unfortunately, we don't have the TDs or the ministers to say, okay, guys, let's take a little pain for a couple of years. Let's get this up and running.
Because this is why the Greens don't exist anymore. The public aren't having it.
The public don't understand it. But listen, Greg, if there was a couple of wires every year and we're on all since Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, radio, TV, what was it? The price of oil. It affects everybody. It affects me, you, Leonard, Brian, and everybody listening.
So you're of the view there is no gouging going on? If
there is gouging,
it's by the government.
The government is gouging. The petrol station phone, where I get mine, the petrol hasn't gone up, as Brian is saying. There are people, I know that, and it's 20 cent dearer 10 miles down the road because the boys have put up the price of the petrol.
So that is gouging then?
There is a certain amount, but what I can say that not all petrol stations are gouging.
And they're not bad people either. It's very important we don't turn petrol station owners into landlords or into whatever it might be. Yeah. They're like, you know, they are business people, and I don't think they are intentionally going to be ripping money out of their neighbours' pockets. I genuinely don't believe that.
But Greg, isn't it great that the government could sit back and have us on debating whether there's gouging going on or not? The only people are gouging is the government. All they have to do is cut the excise tax or the NOLA tax or the carbon tax a little bit, would bring the petrol down for 3, 4, 5 months.
Leonard, we were talking about, you know, the council potentially putting a rent freeze on because of the plight. You know, these carbon taxes, we're going to miss our targets by a country mile. Do you think there is an argument that at least the extra the government's going to make, which Nicholas quite rightly pointed out, when the price of petrol and diesel go up, the exchequer's rubbing its hands together. They're making an absolute fortune off the back of it. Is it naive to expect maybe the government to pause or reduce some of those taxes until such time, you know, that we had a number, maybe $79 per barrel or something, where if it's above, the carbon taxes are suspended, and if it's below, hammer them on. We're never going to do that, though, are we? But would you like to see it, Leonard?
Greg, I agree with what Nicholas said, but I will say to Nicholas, it's not the government's putting the price foil up. They're getting the bounce on the back of it. But I have always thought that the government should take a set amount. It shouldn't be a percentage of the price of diesel, because, as you say, Greg, they've tied in whatever figures we get from oil and diesel in a year. And if there's a bounce on that, they should not be taking the bounce like that. They should set a figure every year. This will not go over this. And if oil goes up or down, this is the figure we're taking.
Yeah. And I have to say, whether or not the panel believe gouging is going on, the consumer does, because, you know, the price of home heating oil was going up without a lorry leaving a yard or coming into a yard, for that matter. The oil was sitting there and increasing in value by 30, 40, 50% to cover the cost of buying oil into the future. Just a couple of comments here. Anyone in rent arrears with the council, you need to pay something to stop the interest building on it. If your rent is €80 a week, you'd be better paying the 50 or 60, otherwise the interest keeps building up. I was in a shop yesterday and an item was marked £4 sterling. I thought it would be €4.60 in euro. It was €6.50. I didn't end up buying it then. You could be caught out. There's a couple of shops that are their main business is in Britain, and they do have British sterling pricing, but it's not to do with... It's not connected to the exchange rate. They seem to have a fixed one that would factor in delivery, etc. Maybe extra wages or what have you. Good morning, Greg. I rang a company on Wednesday morning after 9 a.m. for home heating oil. 500 litres was $6.50. When I rang back a short time later to place an order, the price had gone up to €800 in about 20 minutes since my earlier call. Thanks. That comes in from Charlie in Dunfanaghy. Right, okay. 700 euros yesterday for 500 litres of oil, €800 today. Another 195 cent in our village, 174 cent a few miles up the road for petrol. Well, you know, that's competition. We've talked for a long time about what appeared to be, back in the day, people feeling that in certain areas all the petrol and diesel was the same price, and there were people going, well, what's got, now there's competition, use your feet. Coming up after 10 o'clock, we preview this week's Greg Hughes podcast. We have Mr. Michael Sugrue, who is leaving Letterkenny University Hospital next Thursday after a long career there. But that's only part of his life story and part of his passion. He's heading away, actually, teaching. We'll have a preview of that just after 10 o'clock. And also Seamus Gunn's going to be in answering all of your legal questions. For the moment, we're in the company of Nicholas Crossan, former councillor, independent, in fact, in the Inishowen Municipal District, Leonard Watson, the owner of Watson's Menswear Letterkenny, and Councillor Brian Carr, Sinn Féin councillor in the Glenties Municipal District. Now, earlier in the week, we heard Jim O'Callaghan say it's not his job to be sympathetic. This was as he was responding to a direct question as to why he refused to meet Chrysler families. They're seeking a meeting to find out what's going on. They're continuing their campaign, of course, for an inquiry. The minister is of the view that the criminal proceedings must take their course. But was he right? I'll start with you, Brian. I don't think I've started with you yet. Jim O'Callaghan, he's not the Minister for Sympathy. He's there to get answers, to get justice, and he's committed to doing so. Now, I know the families weren't happy. Some of the families, I can't speak for all, with his reaction. What's your reaction to his comments?
I think it's a terrible comment. Like, the families are not looking for sympathy from him. They're just looking for a meeting to sit down with them, just to have a conversation. And I think it was a very hurtful comment. Like, these families are still grieving, Greg. And, you know, for him not just to agree to come sit down, like, he's not coming to a tribunal. He's only just coming. They only want him to come sit down and listen to their concerns. Like, he could answer some of their valid and genuine questions that they have to ask him just by sitting in a room with them. And like, as I said, I just think that it was, for him to come out with a statement like that, it's very hurtful. And, you know, since the time of the tragedy, at the time of the tragedy, there were so many promises from government and from big politicians and officials and everything. So I think they have to be kind of respectful now and fulfil some of the promises that they made, that they said they would go out of their way to help. They would do everything they possibly could for the families. And I'm saying that the two can't run side by side, a Garda investigation and the tribunal or whatever. You know, it's happened before. So I just think the statement that he said, it was very hurtful to the families and to the people in Donegal as well. Like, I thought to myself, my God, that's a terrible statement.
Yeah, and again, sometimes, you know, whether he believed it to be right or not, that shouldn't be communicated to a journalist in Cavan, really. That should be related to those who were seeking the meeting, surely. That's a respectful thing to do. Leonard, what's your view?
You know, Greg, I didn't actually see this till yesterday evening, and I couldn't believe it when I seen it. Like, you know, words mean everything. Like, this is a mother and a father who've lost a child. And for him to, as you say, to come out with a statement like that, I'm not here to give sympathy, I'm here to give justice. Like, well, it's 3.5 years these families are waiting for justice. Like, you know, and it doesn't matter how many meetings they want, Greg. Like, these families are suffering. Like, and until they get justice and they get a reason, you know, there should be some kind of liaison with the family full time. Like, you know, but just to come out, you know, to use them words,
Helen McEntee, in her period did commit to having a liaison between her department and the families. That never came to pass. So in other words, my point is what you say should be there was already promised but not delivered, Leonard.
Yeah. Like Greg, you know, you go back to the Stardust thing, look how long it took them families to get justice. We can't be, you know, this can't go on for another 2 or 3 years. Like, I'm not saying you rush justice, but like 3.5 years is a long time for families to wait for an answer to what happened. Like, and you know, for him to come out with a statement like that there, you know, I don't know, there should be some kind of apology. An apology probably mean nothing to the families now, but he should be forced to make an apology for that statement there.
Mm. And also to, you know, the whole idea of an inquest, it is for answers as well. But I mean, some answers might be delivered through the criminal proceedings, but it's also to assess why this happened and could it be avoided into the future in terms of, I don't know, a mixed use site, you know, petrol, diesel, accommodation, shop. Is that the right way to do it? Is there any lessons to be learned from that? There is a suspicion it was a gas explosion, of course. What lessons could be learned from that by way of an inquest? A lot of those questions would not be answered, per se, in a criminal investigation. So can we afford to wait? What happens if there is another incident like this and lessons that we could have learned weren't learned? What would Jim O'Callaghan say then?
Yeah, no, Joanne, like Greg, you said there, like, there's lessons to be learned here. Like, at the end of the day, this was an accident of some sort, but this could happen again, because you said there's a lot of buildings very similar to the one in Creasla that have mixed use, that have businesses, have got residential in that. And we have to learn from these lessons. Like, you know, so many things have happened over the year, and we'll say that, you know, there'll be lessons learned. And because nothing was really put in statute, these things happen again. Yeah. And then, you know, we go back to square one again and say, oh, definitely this will not happen again.
And I'm not being semantic, and I know you were just using sort of everyday language, but we actually don't know if it was an accident. And that's, you know what I mean? I'm not being smart, but I think that's part of this whole thing. Nicholas?
Yeah, I agree with the Brian Leonard are saying. I still feel uneasy and uncomfortable speaking about this. It's very raw. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's only just over 3 years since this happened. We have a poor record for tribunals in this country, and Leonard did touch on the Stardust, 1981 to 2024, I think. Mother and Baby's Home, Bloody Sunday and Derry. Yep. So our record in tribunals are not good. But to get back to the question that was asked, the choice of words that the minister brought up, it's different. Minister of Justice, and he's not the Minister of Sympathy, but that's not...
Well, he never referenced himself as that. That was casual language for me. He said, his exact quote is, it's not my job to be sympathetic.
Yes, and he's right to a certain extent, but it's a wrong choice of words, or totally different wrong choice of words. Those families are grieving, and although sometimes all people want is the truth. Mm. The answers, just answers to their questions. And sometimes you can just say two or three lines and it puts somebody a little bit more at ease, and never a bit ease these families. Mm. And I think that for Brian or Jim O'Callaghan, and I do think that he's a very, very clever boy, but he definitely didn't
just
read the
on the point of him being clever, and I've no doubt he has a great deal of intelligence. What people in the public eye need to do, he should have thought for a moment and literally taken a moment and said, if the families of the 10 people were standing in front of me, would I say to them, it's not my job to be sympathetic? Yeah, and the answer to that is he wouldn't. But those families have to hear those words as if he were standing in front of them.
I think the minister should, if the families are looking for a meeting with them, they have a meeting without jeopardising maybe whatever would go through the tribunal, because I'm not legally au fait, but I think that they should have a discussion, leave it out what they know so far, and see if that will help the families to get over the hurdle that they're
I know what you're saying, but to be clear, the families are kept well abreast of the criminal investigation. Some information has gone to the DPP. Yeah. Further information is to go. My understanding is they all have Garda liaison officers, and they are satisfied with the level of communication there. In their pursuit of a public inquiry into this, this is where the major gaps in information seem to be. But
Just on that point before you go off. Should the minister say, right, okay, this is what we're going to do. Let's have a time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say it's going to be 2 years, 3 years from now, or whatever the case may be, and tell the families on the 1st of January 2028, we will have a report, a full report done and on. But this thing, it goes on and on and on ad nauseum, and it's terrible altogether.
But that is called communication, and unfortunately, there's a severe lack of communication. Councillor Nicholas Crossan, go ahead. Brian, was that Brian?
But, as I said, starting out there, it's just to come down, sit, meet the families. Maybe he can answer questions that some other, they're not being getting answers maybe from the Garda liaison or anything like that, you know. And we're asking about, both Leonard and Nicholas, you know, said that we need, lessons need to be learned. Well, the lesson, as I said, Bloody Sunday, you know, the Stardust, 50 years. We can't let the Creasley families wait 50 years for proper answers or to get justice for what did happen.
And it seems crazy that we're in the now. And we are literally trying to now say, let's not make the same mistakes we made historically. Yeah. Okay, listen, thank you, all three of you, very much indeed for joining us.
Can I just say one point on a lighter note?
No, well, I, do you know what my next question was going to be to you? Is there anything you want to plug? But go on anyway.
No, there's nothing I want to plug. I would just like to say that to the women's, for the Women's Day, that it was very thoughtful of you to put on three men and give the
day off. I referenced that.
on a good note as well, Greg, I just want to say that we had a fight in this area a number of years ago, Save Loch Anna, and we got a good result 10 years ago when they told us that Loch Anna wasn't going to be decommissioned, and they told us they were going to spend £1 million on Loch Anna to upgrade it to top-class drinking water. And 2 days ago, it was announced that Loch Anna is now off the RAL for the first time in 20 years, and they have spent $18.3 million on that lake. And our neighbours in Letchamacca Ward treatment, they've got $12 million spent.
Happy days, I do give
out a bit of ishgear and a lot, but that's 6,650 people that's going to be drinking good water from now on. So
there's a castle at Loch Anna, isn't there?
Sorry?
A castle at Loch
Anna? No, there's not.
All right,
it's just the loveliest lake in the world.
Must be a different Loch Anna I'm thinking of. Okay, listen, thank you for your time. Lovely stuff, Councillor Brian Carr. Leonard, anything you want to plug?
Well, do you what, Greg? I just want to...
No, we've done that already. Don't forget, Greg, I'm going to be shopping soon. Go on.
No, but that's something that, in fairness, you fought for as well. The CAMS, Intellectual Disability Psychiatrist, will be in place now in March. This is huge for the families
in
Donegal.
Brilliant.
This is something that we've been fighting for a long time. And I just want to thank you too, Greg. In fairness, you've been a huge supporter of it and keeping it at the front line. So, and in fairness to the HSE, they have stepped up here, and this will make so much difference to the families in and around Donegal.
It really will, and that's what we're all here for, so that's good. Well done. Thanks so much, Leonard. Nicholas, thank you so much. You've nothing to plug in Bunkrana?
No, I'd just like to thank you for the wee plug that we got for the pantomime. It was a huge success, and thank you very much.
Actually, I think you've still got a bit of lipstick on.
Well, I have, probably might have.
Just to remind you, coming up after 10 o'clock, we've got a sneak preview of this week's Greg Hughes podcast, which is available for you on our website, Spotify and iTunes from 11 a.m. And our guest is Mr. Michael Sugrue. After 20-odd years, more maybe, of dedication to health services here in Donegal, he's hanging up his scrubs next Thursday for a new exciting adventure. And in the podcast, we hear about his work, his career, his life, his loves. And it's very interesting. So hopefully you'll listen to the pod. And after 10, we're going to give you a wee preview, just in case you prefer to listen to it that way. And of course, Seamus Gunn's going to be joining us, because he's going to be answering all of your legal questions, or as many as we can get to. So that's all coming up after 10. Don't forget to keep your calls and comments coming into us, though. 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and text number. Or you can give us a call on 07491 25000. Seamus Gunn's going to be joining us in the not too distant future. We have questions in for him, as you can imagine. It's always busy. Keep them coming in to us. But I also don't want to neglect your comments on defective blocks. Greg, the amount of people that I'm chatting to since last summer about their houses falling apart and the amount of their own money they're out is ridiculous. 50, 60, 80, 100 grand to get their home rebuilt again. Only in Ireland, says that texter. Greg, could you tell me why the petrol prices? Sorry, could you tell me why the petrol station in our town has fuel for over €2 a litre since yesterday? Price gouging at its finest. Price gouging on oil has got people up in arms like never before, says a listener. There was already a variance on prices here and not much word of it. A war situation has caused the current increase, so can at least be understood. Plenty of gouging going on with many other things here, but I do find it interesting to see what's getting people annoyed. It's the government's fault for the price of diesel and petrol. They alone are reaping the benefit of this. And what's more, there is more oil in the Irish Sea to keep Ireland for life, but our government gave this away also. There is no oil actually taken from the Irish Sea, as far as I'm aware. I must double check that, actually. Petrol price was 181, now 209, up 28 cent. Now, that's not right. Do you remember this notional ceiling we had when the situation in Ukraine erupted, this €2 ceiling? Do you remember, like, it's like, well, we can't let it go to two, or if it goes to two, it's going to be an absolute blooming crisis. And here we are now, you know, quite some time later, petrol and diesel in some places exceeding that €2 and €2 per litre. And it's not, doesn't seem to be the same crisis. And on oil prices and electricity, when the price falls, the same companies say they can't pass on pricing as they've agreed pricing in advance, hedging. No word of this now when prices goes up. The Taoiseach will pay lip service to gouging and do nothing as per everything else. And the argument being is they reduce the prices when there's stability in the market, right? So they have it everywhere and we don't. A pint of oil is cheaper than a pint of beer. Yes, but not as delicious. How can the Enoch Burke case be... Oh, sorry, okay. We can throw that one out. How can the Enoch Burke case be solved, in your opinion? This is going on for a long time. I don't know if that's me. My view on this has been, for the longest time, is that he's achieving nothing at the moment in prison. I think he's achieving nothing in how he's articulating his argument. I think there's quite a lot of people are sympathetic to him and to his point of view. I think he should just commit to not going to that school where he's not wanted, and use his platform to get his message out if that's what he wants to do. That would be my advice, but they won't take that advice, of course, and on it goes. Right, OK, let's go to a preview of this week's podcast. And my guest, and by the way, just to recap for you, that each Friday at 11 a.m. we release the Greg Hughes podcast. It's a sister podcast to the show. We've had some really interesting stories, really interesting people on over the course of the last couple of months. And my latest guest, we recorded last night here in studio. It's Mr. Michael Sugrue. And I wasn't aware until very recently, if I'm completely honest with you, that Michael Sugrue is leaving Letterkenny University Hospital. He is going off to teach in Asia, I believe it is. But he is a very interesting man, originally from Galway. He spent 2 decades working in Australia. And it's a very interesting story. He has a very, very deep love of Donegal, its scenery, primarily its people, even though he's a Galwegian, if that's the right phrase, a person from Galway, his heart's very much in, and his soul is very much in County Donegal. Right, so let's catch up. Here's a little bit of the podcast by way of a preview.
Well, first of all good ideas come from Pauline, and I remember coming, and she said...
I really should have brought Pauline in here.
Yeah, you should have her in here instead of me, yes. She's much more interesting. So the Breast Cancer Ball was really there to bring the community in. You know, there's a great thing here in Donegal is that the community have an interlinkage with the hospital, certain aspects of the hospital anyway, that's really healthy. So the idea was really a celebration of survivors and an opportunity to raise some money, because there is no funding for research. In my entire 18 years, I have not received any health department or university. Well, we did get €2,000 from NUIG.
Bring out the marching bands.
Yeah, so we had to raise that money ourselves. And the Breast Ball, on average, raises about 15,000 a year. So that's nearly 250,000 that was raised and used for research. Mm. And it's a night of a bit of fun. The committees have been fantastic. Maura Lynham led them for years. You know, we've had Betty and so many others and join in. So it's been a great night out and people love it. Mm. So, and it brings money in for the research. So
I think it wins on so many different levels, yeah, doesn't it? There's no doubt about that. It's really counterintuitive, isn't it, to sort of have people who are very keen and can prove the research, but not to fund it. Is that because we were overlooked, or is that just not a particular focus of the HSE?
Well, it isn't the focus of the HSE specifically, and I can understand this, Greg, because we have to provide clinical care. Mm-hmm. So the HSE has got to provide clinical care. But what is really good is if you can combine research with clinical care, it's a win-win situation. So in terms of this, if you identify optimal care, then look at it and see is it being implemented, you can then actually improve delivery of care. So it should be hand in hand. But I can understand how people want delivery of care. Mm-hmm. And that is more important than research. But they do go hand in hand and they make a huge difference.
Yeah. In terms of your efforts to improve the situation in Letterkenny, and most recently, you know, your campaign, and it's not just a campaign, sorry, but actually you're articulating the argument for Letterkenny to be a Model 3, the delivery of a surgical hub. Back in the day, it was fighting for breast surgeons, working with hospital campaigners, right? So we could never, I don't think we would ever have time enough to really give your efforts the credit that they deserve, because you were also doing this whilst being a family man, enjoying some of your hobbies, which we'll get to, but also actually being an incredibly busy surgeon. How have you balanced all of that over the years?
I think I probably have an issue with fairness, Greg. Mm. I don't know what part of my brain it affects, but I fundamentally can't stand unfairness. And it's a matter of principle. It's a matter of principle where why should we not receive the same opportunity? Now, we have to accept, Greg, that Letterkenny is geographically removed from Dublin, and there are services we can never have, nor should we ever have here. But for basic services, we need to be funded to the same degree. And I suppose when I worked in Sydney, I saw working in the most deprived area of southwest Sydney, where the original population was about 120,000, rising to 350,000, I could see that the hospital, Liverpool University Hospital, was really neglected. Mm-hmm. And through a whole activity and change of plan, it's now the biggest hospital in Australia.
So that's what can be achieved.
It can be achieved. Now, obviously, Letterkenny is not going to be St. James's or anything like that, but it was just wonderful to see that transition, and it's now a leader in so many areas of medicine. So in Letterkenny, working with the team of, you know, 15 consultants and some nursing staff and other team members, we really began to feel that this isn't right. And to actually bring that to the fore, you need the facts. And the facts sometimes can be embarrassing.
And I just on that, and I want you to continue, there are obviously a couple of ways that you can achieve what you wish to achieve. Deputies can support you in the Dáil and make very strong arguments, and 100 and 200 or 300 people can march around the border of the hospital with placards. But perhaps one of the most boring elements, but the most critical elements, is actually making a legitimate argument, which is what you undertook. And as I say, the detail which you would have put together would be far too complex for me, or perhaps most people listening. But to point out the differences between this hospital, the other hospital, the demographic, you know, the arguments for and against and here. And that has been critical. That's been really, really critical, as well as the pressure in any advancements we're seeing right now. Would you agree?
Yes, I think the most important thing is you have to have the facts and you have to have the evidence to support your case. And I hope that the Model 3 report, which I worked on with a team, and it was part of my job, Greg. It wasn't...
No, I understand.
Was part of my job. I hope when that is published, and it will be published, I have no doubt, and it hopefully will be published soon, that people will be able to understand the facts behind the situation. And when that is published, it will become clear the course of action that is required to address the inequality. So,
How optimistic are you for the future of Letterkenny University Hospital? Because, of course, you know, there's an awful lot going on in different areas of the hospital, and we know we've got the community hospital coming on stream, the HSC's committing to, you know, to have the funding for more home care packages, home care hours, etc. So there's different strands going off in all different directions with a view to hopefully bringing the hospital to a point whereby, I mean, hospitals, acute hospitals are designed really to run at capacity, aren't they, or close there to it, right? But where are we now, and how optimistic are you when all of these different things that I've mentioned, plus the hub, plus the injuries clinic, etc., come online? How optimistic are you?
I'm very optimistic, Greg. Very optimistic. And I'm fundamentally very optimistic because of the volume of people in Donegal. So that in itself can't go away.
Mm-hmm.
You have 180,000 people. They need treatment. We're not a Portiuncle, we're not a Wexford. We haven't got a necklace of 6 to 8 hospitals in our region that we can go to at ease. So the actual facts have been listened to by the minister and the politicians. So they have rallied around. They now understand the situation we're in. The minister understands it. And I think her decisions last July really gave us hope. I believe for almost the first time, real hope, because she is a leader and she has made these decisions that there has to be equity.
And also what has to happen in these situations, there has to be a motion set in chain. And we are sitting in planning permissions. We did recently see, as we record this, the 2026 budget having some provision for some of the developments we're talking about. So the wheels are in motion. So if Micheál Martin or whomever it is decided to have a cabinet reshuffle, someone would have to reverse the decisions. There's enough progress that it's as much as anything can be locked in.
Yes. So the things that we've, the big picture items that we've recently received are the surgical hub, 100 million. We've received oncology enhancements so badly needed. And the minister has given a commitment to the development control plan, which is worth 400 to 500 million. So these are three key things. If you add into that recent appointments, we have a new breast surgeon just started this week. How fantastic is that? Second breast radiologist. You know, that's just one service. If we go to the trainee, you know, the foreman, so to speak, under the gov, these are higher surgical. That's what I was when I went to Australia, if you remember that part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. They've just doubled the number of trainees. You know, the facts show that we're completely underdone. So the medical training bodies in Ireland have doubled the number of trainees. So this is really, really important, Greg, because it allows the foremen, and I use the word foremen, it could be four women, but it's so important to the hospital. So the infrastructure is going to improve, and we're having a number, an increased number of applications for positions. So I'm very optimistic.
And success breeds success.
It does.
And it becomes more attractive. Okay, that was Mr. Michael Sugrue. Just trying to get his a sense, whilst I had the opportunity, of where we are at now. But the conversation begins with his involvement in medicine and his training and his travel, and how he became a specialist in the area, in the areas that he is, his love of the county. We go on something of a tour around Donegal to his favourite walking spots, and of course what the future holds for him. That's going to be live, available for you to download and listen to on our website, highlandradio.com, on Spotify and iTunes from 11 o'clock today. Okay, delighted to welcome onto the programme now, Seamus Gunn. How are you, Seamus? Good to see you again.
Hi, how are you? Good to see you, yeah.
I'm fantastic. Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin, Gunn Solicitors and Letterkenny. We've loads of questions coming in for you. Just wondering, obviously you're keeping a very close eye on the world and the way it's at the moment.
Oh, yeah. Well, how could you miss? It just seems to be moving at some pace and some speed. We have now a seven-day new war since we last spoke. You had Maduro a couple of months ago in Venezuela and taken to the USA under armed forces, and saw a lot of casualties there, which sort of went, I wouldn't say unnoticed, but it wasn't condemned with any great enthusiasm by any of the other major powers.
No, and Venezuela and the US overnight reopened diplomatic relations. So Donald Trump would see that as a win, I'm sure.
Well, he does, yeah, and it'll be portrayed as a win. And how will this be portrayed for generations to come? Last Saturday's attack on Iran, it's going to be very, very difficult to call, because If we get to a stage where it becomes normal, the normalization of a sort of a unilateral attack by a nation on another nation, and because it has more heavyweight behind it or whatever, that it is bigger than the international law, well, we're gradually moving down onto a very, very slippery slope. The question will be asked, of course, like, as far as the UN goes, this would seem, it's very hard to justify this attack, because it hasn't been sanctioned by the Security Council. On the face of it, it's not self-defence, or I can't see it as being self-defence as such. It's a preemptive strike. If you want to argue the self-defence, Trump will say, well, there was an imminent threat. There's a threat to global security. There's a threat of nuclear power coming from Iran, and that was still there. Yet back a few months ago, maybe in June or sometime like that, he was supposed to have obliterated that threat. But now that's sort of justified to say, well, this is why we've gone in this time and taken out Khomeini, who's been there for 40 plus years. Is that the right way to do it? Well, I can't see that it is, because at that measurement, then all the standards have completely dropped. The United Nations and being a member of it, it doesn't hold an awful lot of clout. Mm. And as far as the US are concerned, they're going to do what they consider appropriate. And it's not even in their backyard. And then Trump will argue, of course, well, I can do this for 60 days at least, because under the US legal system, there's an act, a War Powers Resolution back in the 70s, was introduced. So he can really actually wage war for 60 days before Congress get involved. But under the Constitution, Congress are the only ones that can declare war. But before he's pulled up, and now this week, they're trying to maybe get the House of Representatives and the Senate to come together, which haven't got a snowball's chance in hell of vetoing him. So he will continue on with, to some degree, impunity. And I don't think that that's good for world order.
No, is it possible they're underestimating the Iranians, though? Because, of course, they're prolific drone manufacturers, and we really don't know how many missiles they have, and they could literally just ride this out, because it costs 20 or 30,000 euros for them to create one drone, and the missile to intercept that drone can cost anything up to 2 or 3 million euro. And there's not an infinite supply of those missiles in that region. So if they can hold out, continue to launch missiles, continue to launch drones, there is a point whereby the defence systems are exhausted, and even the United States arsenal of weapons heavily, heavily depleted, because they've been making a fortune selling them to Ukraine and they don't really have a great plan to replenish them. They want to be careful they're not underestimating the resilience of the Iranians. They could find themselves in a very, very tricky situation over there.
No, I think that's well made. All right, I would accept that. And I think that this maybe adds a little bit of weight to it. If you go into a country or one attacks another country and takes out the leader who has been there for 40 plus years, regardless of what we think of him, If you reverse the roles and seen it as an attack in the USA, well, all hell would break loose in that scenario, and you could be looking straight down the barrel of a third world war. So if you reverse it, if you say that 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 will garnish far more forthright defence by the Iranians, because the Ayatollah Khomeini has been taken out by another power without, as they would consider, no justification. And then if you flip it over, you'll say, but they are now hitting other states that are not really involved, but they have an association with the USA. And again, that would be in breach of all international law and UN as well. But the taking out of the president, the leader of a country, it's very, very strong, and it will hit hard with those that are trenchant in their views, in the Islamic views. And that could add, of course, to the length of time that this goes on and what that will do to world order, who knows. Or will Trump start losing interest again and maybe move on to something else?
Well, you see, I think he's bombing a path into Iran for the likes of the exiled Kurdish, opposition Kurdish groups, which within themselves are splintered. And if Iran has no firm leadership and the Americans decide we've done enough here, I can see generations of dispute, fighting, death over parts of or the entirety of Iran. It's not a country where you just get rid of one political leadership and it's replaced by another. There's lots of people, lots of groups that have been waiting for a long, long time to get in there and claim what they believe is rightfully theirs. So whether or not the Americans have an involvement, I think the disruption is going to be felt for a long, long time. And the life of people in Iran, as bad as the previous administration, some feel, was, is going to be very, very difficult for a very long time. That would be my fear.
Yeah, and on that very point, like when you see a national school, I think it was there during the week, was bombed with maybe 170 plus deaths, actually, children killed and teachers in it. That really brings it home to you as to where this is going. And if one then expects that the Iranians are going to take that and not retaliate and using all their firepower as intelligently as they can do and will do, I think one would be very naive. Mm.
And China is watching on, looking at how stretched the United States is. They've got their own ambitions on Taiwan, etc. I mean, if Russia decides it wants Ukraine, the Americans decide what it wants for other countries, why would the Chinese sit in their hands and look weak and not go in and take Taiwan like they say is rightfully theirs?
If that, Greg, is becoming the new world order, as I said, this normalization of unilateral strikes, whereby they say, well, we're justified anyway and nobody can stop us, then who knows where we end up.
Just to remind you, by the way, coming up after 11 o'clock, John Breslin is live around the Northwest from the Clanree Hotel. It's part of Local Enterprise Week, the show on from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. The Made in Donegal Business Summit and Showcase is open to the public today from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. I was at the one last year, and it's a lovely little event to walk around, by the way, and see the amazing innovation and produce that's available here in our county. So get along to that. Lots of great guests there. Paddy McBurty, Jason Quigley, two greats of Donegal sport. Katrina Jennings, Peter Mulryan, Andrea Shaw, Rosie Temple and Sean Flood are all going to be in attendance here. I'm making do with the company of Seamus Gunn, McLaughlin Gunn, Solicitors and Letterkenny. Great company, actually, I should say. Yeah. Seamus, some time ago I had some dealings with a solicitor, and that solicitor has the deeds of my house. Then I moved, and now I made my will with another solicitor. Do both of these have to be done by the one solicitor, or does it matter? So the wills, the deeds of the house is with one, and the will is with another. Should they be under the one roof? Does it matter?
Well, the answer is no, it doesn't really. It would be unusual, though, for if one had dealt with maybe their home or their property and that, and they were putting arrangements in place, that they may use the same firm to act. But it's certainly not necessary. They can easily employ, and some people have several different representations in the legal world for different types of specialty. So you could have a firm dealing with conveyance, and then somebody then wanting to deal with making arrangements, putting their wills in place. So yes, but and this is a slight but, like, for the purpose of continuity and for the reason that those coming after like to have that and know where the person had their business and done their business, and, you know, their significant buying of a house and dealing with that through their lifetime, it wouldn't be unusual for the same firm to continue to act, but absolutely not. They can make their arrangements with whomsoever they so wish, and their deeds do not have to be there for sure.
Yeah, it feels a wee bit like buying your suit jacket in one shop and your suit trousers in another. You can do it if you want to.
They might not match. And I think that there's a little bit more to it.
I know.
But at the same time, it has been a tradition, you know, that firms act sort of in for families and that, and then maybe the next generation moves on, understandably so and all. But it is that continuity that people do like, and it's kind of a one stop shop if you get it. Mm-hmm. So. But if you're buying slacks and a jacket, I would be inclined to shop around myself.
Is there anywhere I can access a will which I'm not mentioned in, Seamus? Does the public have a right to access to wills or only one they are mentioned in?
This can be quite emotive, this, because people are curious. We're all curious, you know, and this is why sometimes you may have seen in papers, especially some Sunday titles, where they publish what an individual has left in an estate. Mm. That is because once the will is submitted for probate and probate has issued, and this is where it may help the caller, once probate has issued, the will is then a document of public record, and the estate, the value of the estate is there for one to see or to look up or to do a search in the probate registry office or the probate office in Dublin to find out what did Joe Bloggs leave in his will. And if sometimes people like to see if it's a personality of some sort, you know, again, the curiosity aspect of it, or indeed if it's a family member who is feeling a little bit left out, hard done by, and would like to see how that estate was dealt with. At that point, they could access. They don't necessarily need a lawyer to do it, but they could certainly access the probate, and therefore accessing the will after it is admitted to probate. Now, if the estate is negligible and it doesn't require probate, well, then it may never become public, and then we flip it over again and say, well, you know, in these situations for families, maybe it's best for all concerned communication that they see it and they don't think that there's anything untoward in it, which usually there isn't, that maybe they should be allowed a copy of it. And that would be at the discretion of the executors or the executor to make that decision if they so wish. Mm. But until it's admitted to probate, if the executor says no, they have no interest in that, that is the decision and that is their right to do that. And they're charged with that authority and the obligation to carry out the wishes in accordance with the will. But if somebody wants to find out what's in it, if they wait until probate issues, that's when they can make their move.
Coincidentally, here's the flip side of it. This is a question that came in completely separately. A newspaper printed the amount my dad left in his will. How is this anything but my family's business? And do I have any rights to take a case for invasion of privacy? I think you've answered this, but I mean, it's a good question. Go ahead, Seamus.
Yeah, so we've dealt with, over a few years, we've dealt with quite a few interesting type questions. We've never got one like this, I don't believe, ever, because it raises the point that we just touched on there about, how could this have happened? Well, I think I'm after explaining how it could have happened, because in these situations, it can be published once it becomes a document of public record. And Therefore, it's supposedly, do I agree? I may not agree. It may not be in the public interest, but it is in the public domain, and has been put into that by way of being admitted to probate, and therefore the obviously the media have some access to it, and they therefore publish it. So the individual's asking, it certainly may have an impact on their privacy, but that is the dilemma that they're in, that once the probate issues, it becomes a document of public record, and that is how that probably has arisen in the first place.
Yeah, another privacy question, I suppose you could argue. Can the media, which they do, so of course they can the media take a photo of someone exed in court and publish it? Can you seek for it to be taken down? Are they allowed to do that, to put your photo up without asking you first? So you'd see this more commonly. There are obviously people that's their job to take these pictures. Normally someone seems to be vaping.
Yeah, no, it is a privacy question. And sure, we see it every day in all the national titles. It's quite common. I think that the point, though, we go back to basics. It's in a public forum, and so therefore, when you're in a public forum, that privacy, that obligation does not extend to that, and therefore that's why you do see photographs appearing. And now, if they were in some way printed in a way that could be derogatory or defamatory or used in a certain way, well, that's entirely different, or some slant put on them. But as far as being in public and having been photographed, there's nothing I believe that you could do to suppress that in the press itself, because the press have the freedom to publish such pictures.
You talked about how it might be portrayed, but a lot of these articles now end up on social media, where it can be the Wild West in the comment section. I mean, there is a liability there as well, just because you post it on a third party social media platform. It doesn't mean that you are insulated from, you know, liability for people's comments on it.
No, but it also doesn't mean that you're responsible for people's comments on it. But it does, that's the world we're living in.
Yeah.
You know, and unfortunately these are the pitfalls in the social media platforms. And I mean, if there's an inference or there's a comment made by an individual, as you so referenced, well, then at that point, you can make an application to have it removed by that particular platform that it appears on, and go through that process. But for the purpose of the question and the publication and the press, I don't see an issue with that.
Is it possible to split up a two-story house in a will between two different people? So one family member would get upstairs and the other would get downstairs, for an example. Access, by the way, they point out.
It used to be a very good program. Well, it was a soap, wasn't it?
Upstairs, downstairs.
many years ago, and it ran for some period of time. The answer is yes, it is. It could be tricky now, but there's nothing to prohibit somebody doing that. There's a couple of little points though I would probably tease out, that if so, you want to first of all identify as to why, what's the purpose of it. Is there an apartment on the first floor and another apartment on the second floor, and they're two independent units, which is fine. In that case, there would be common areas that would be shared, and maybe they would need easements in respect of access in one, and access in the ground floor, maybe an access in the top floor. So I would suggest and recommend that in that case, you would obtain a map, I think, would be critical to show the actual floor areas, to identify them specifically, and to identify the requirements, services, easements that are needed to service each of them. So that they would be used in common, and that each party would have peaceful enjoyment and independent enjoyment of their own property, and that it would be mapped off accordingly. Otherwise, I could see it being difficult. And if they're saying, well, it's just as simple as this, one gets the upstairs and one gets the down, I think that they would want to tease that out a little bit better, maybe, and get some maybe engineering advice or architect's advice as to how the property is going to be used in the future by those coming after them. But it certainly can be done. And if that is one's wish, once they plot it out right, map it out right, maybe take some advice on how to do that, what the next purpose of it's going to be, it could work, yes.
Seamus, thank you. It's always a pleasure to have you on the programme. Every time I speak to you, we edge ever closer to summer, but that's not the only reason I enjoy speaking to you. If you want to get in contact with Seamus and the team, they have physical offices in Letterkenny and Remalta, McLaughlin Gunn Solicitors. And Seamus, that online presence, sweeping the internet, you're viral almost at this stage.
Every minute of every day, Greg, yes. Gunn.ie, DonegalSolicitors.ie if you want the longer version, but the other is simpler.
All right, look after yourself. Thank you very much indeed. That is Seamus Gunn there. Let's take a break. I'll be back with the weather forecast this Friday, the 6th of March. I hope you're well. The Grand Parish Fundraising Concert, takes place tomorrow night, in fact, at 8 p.m. in the Greencastle Community Centre. You're invited to come along and join in for a night of great entertainment with local artists, including David Casey and Lauren Harkin, Musical Memories with Patsy Kavanagh and Father Colum, Clodagh Warnock, Geraldine Kavanagh, and students from Mayville Community College. Michaela Harkin, Declan McNichol, Finbar and Joanne, Michael Kavanagh with Brian Lafferty. So that's a cracking lineup of entertainment, isn't it? Admission is just €10. It's payable at the door, and there's a raffle on the night. And all proceeds will go towards the renovations at St. Mary's Church, Ballybrack, as well as the extension of the graveyard. So a fun night out by the sounds of things, but also raising money there for that good local cause. Greg, we could shout as much as you like about fuel prices. The Taoiseach will say this is terrible. They'll have a review, which means nothing will happen, really. No one is going to get the extra money back that they paid this week. It's just sound bites. Ministers can talk for 5 minutes and say absolutely nothing, talking about guidelines and structures and frameworks, and no one ever seems to really question them properly. But do you know what? I'm not sure if it was always the case, but certainly it's the case. And I'm not sure if it's only here in the Northwest or if it's across the country. People are very clever now as to what's going on, and they can see through words and behind words, in good and bad as well. So no one's going to get their eyes, the wool pulled over their eyes round here anyway. We can take that to the bank. Is the government discriminating against the Burke family? I know of many court orders for barring orders for access to children by non-abusive parents where the father or mother received no sanction. This is endemic. I'm not really sure if there's a grade of court orders, to be honest with you. It's only Enoch that's in court for breach of a court order, but he's also trespassing on a place that he's not wanted. So, you know, it is an issue because the law has to be seen to be done. Will we get an injuries unit in Donegal? And when I've heard that the new extension for ED doesn't have an injuries unit, there is an injuries unit. There's funding to begin the process of it happening. So there are plans for an injuries unit at Letterkenny University Hospital. As being discussed in Britain, should Irish exiles in Dubai have to pay the cost of their own flights home? Well, I threw that out yesterday. €800 is the cost for a seat. I chucked it out yesterday, and I know there's quite a few people. I'm in contact with people that have got home but are still out there and looking to get home. And none of them have kicked up a storm about this €800. So they don't seem to be terribly worried about it. Jim O'Callaghan simply slipped up and told the truth. He simply doesn't care. That's in relation to that comment about it's not his job to be sympathetic. Now, I want to mention something that was launched yesterday around the Northwest, and it's a great little competition. And when I say little, it's not actually a little at all. It's quite big. It's a €10,000 home makeover plus €10,000 cash competition. So Highland Radio presents the ultimate chance to transform your home with the €10,000 home makeover draw, plus an extra €10,000 in cash brought to you in association with Foy & Company, with showrooms in Letterkenny, Ballybuffet and Enniskillen. So if you enter, you get €10,000 to do with what you will. That could be for a holiday, a cruise, it could be to write down a loan, whatever it might be. Or you could add it to the €10,000 you have to spend on home improvements, which will get you an awful lot. Either focus on one room or do multiple adjustments to a number of rooms. So to be in with a chance of winning this fantastic prize, you just buy a ticket online. You know the system, highlandradio.com. There's a winner home makeover section. You answer a simple question and choose your entry. Tickets are €15 for one. You can get 5 tickets for 50, so effectively there are 10 each. And the draw takes place on Thursday, the 2nd of April, and it's going to be broadcast live on around the Northwest. So it's less than a month to get your ticket. So don't miss your chance to upgrade your home and win big again with Highland Radio in association with our great friends at Foy & Company. 10 grand to spell on goods there, 10 grand cash to do with what you wish. Not too bad, is it? If you want to be involved, get on to the website, highlandradio.com, and you'll have your ticket in your back pocket for that draw on Thursday, the 2nd of April, around the Northwest with John Breslin. Right, now, just to remind you that coming up after 11 o'clock, John Breslin Show, don't tune away from that, but at your leisure, when you wish to choose to do so, you can listen to the latest edition of the Greg Hughes podcast on our website in the listen back section. It's our conversation with Mr. Michael Sugrue as he prepares to depart Letterkenny University Hospital. He's been just an instrumental part of the conversation of Letterkenny University Hospital, not just because so many of you have spoken so highly of him over the years, but also in his work campaigning and also working behind the scenes on documents to make a very strong argument for investment in the hospital. But he's got a very interesting life, his time in Australia, his return to home, his wife's business interests and his plans for the future and his love of the county as well. So that's available to you from 11 a.m. But that's where we leave it on the programme for today. Thanks to all of you who listen to the show throughout the course of the week, and for those of you who watch it, it's very much appreciated. Have a wonderful weekend, stay safe. We'll be back with you on Monday morning at 9 a.m.